Welcome back to another episode of Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Karim Mamutlu. And on today's show, we welcome back Matt Geiger, who's the managing partner at MJG Capital. Welcome back to the show, Matt.
Great. Thanks for having me, Karim.
In one of our previous interviews, we talked about the nickel market and how you are very bullish on the sector. So what is your take on the recent news from Indonesia and that they've moved forward their export ban by 2 years? The nickel price reacted strongly on the back of this news. And because of this, there is now definitely more of a focus on the nickel market, with some analysts suggesting that more tightness and perhaps some possible supply disruption is inevitable over the next few years. So what's your view on where we are today for nickel, Matt?
So I think we last chatted about nickel only a few months ago, Karim. And this was when the price was trading between $5.50 to $6 US per pound. And at that point, I believe this was in May, nickel was already one of the top performing metals in 2019, having a very solid year with roughly 20 to 25% price gains over the course of the year from the lows in late 2018. So my focus when we last talked was on the long-term demand picture for battery grade class one nickel, as electric vehicle adoption continues to accelerate over the next 5 to 10 years. And more importantly, as battery manufacturers transition from 622 and 523 NCM cathode chemistries to 811 and eventually 9.5 and 1/2. And in fact, interesting data point from just a couple months ago. The 811 chemistry, that's 8 parts nickel, 1 part cobalt, 1 part manganese, saw a massive 251% year-over-year increase in deployment just through April of this year, which I think is indicative of this trend. And I think this will continue. And as I mentioned in the last interview, I'm not a big fan of Elon Musk personally, but agree wholeheartedly with his quip that lithium-ion batteries should really be renamed nickel-ion batteries. Due to their properties. So despite slower than expected EV growth in China, since Beijing in June began cutting subsidies on EV vehicles, I still believe that both of these trends, both electric vehicle adoption and the increasingly nickel-rich chemistries, are still firmly intact. And for what it's worth, my intuition is that this nickel narrative is sexy enough to really be embraced by the market like lithium and cobalt in years prior. I think it's just a matter of time. So all that said, the surge in nickel prices that we've seen since May and in early June have precisely nothing to do with this demand narrative and everything to do with supply, thanks to the Indonesia drama, as you mentioned. As many of your listeners may be aware, after months of speculation, the Indonesian government announced on September 2nd that nickel ore exports leaving the country would be banned starting on January 1st of next year. So they moved it up 2 years from what was expected. The country is doing this to accelerate the building of smelters in country so that Indonesia can sell value-added nickel products such as stainless steel and maybe potentially EV batteries as well. Given that Indonesia is the world's largest producer of nickel, with the country accounting for roughly 30% of global nickel production, which is a sizable number. This is a very big deal to the industry, and I do believe that the price spike that we've seen to five-year highs above $8 per pound is justified, assuming that you believe that there's no imminent global recession. So in terms of getting exposure to nickel, the MJG Fund has 3 nickel-focused holdings in our portfolio. Two of which are Daya Resources and Samma Resources, I wrote about in the fund's most recent investor letter. I think depending on one's risk tolerance, I'd suggest that there are 3 ways to intelligently position oneself in nickel. The first is through high-quality producers of nickel sulfide deposits, such as Western Areas, the ASX producer. The second is promising nickel sulfide explorers and developers, and Samma Resources fits into this mold. And the third would be cashed up owners of massive laterite resources in hospitable jurisdictions, the quote unquote optionality plays, such as Cleantech or Ardea. These names, of course, are not recommendations for your listeners, and instead should be viewed as examples of the kind of nickel companies I'm looking at through this framework.
You recently sent out your latest investor letter, and you just mentioned that. So one of the key points that struck me from this was a stronger focus on the precious metal juniors going forward. You've always included a few gold and silver juniors as key holdings, but I get the impression that the time for investors to be positioned in the precious metal space is now. Would that be correct, Matt? And in your mind, does this year perhaps mark the start of another bullish phase for both metals?
So you are right to note that our precious metal exposure is markedly higher than it has been in previous years, with our gold and silver equities comprising roughly 50 to 55% of the weighted portfolio. Just 6 months ago, for some context, this weighting was closer to 30% of the overall portfolio. So, but I will say this increase over the course of the past, 6 to 9 months has less to do with a concerted effort on my part to increase exposure to PMs, and it has much more to do with substantial outperformance of our existing gold and silver picks. Additionally, two placements that we participated in earlier this year, Kootenay Silver and Bravada Gold, have doubled in price with both sets of warrants now in the money. So these recent deals, and again, this success has less to do with good picks and more to do with good timing, have also led to the higher precious metal exposure we're seeing in the portfolio today. And as I mentioned in the letter, I'm comfortable being overweight PM equities, especially in a world where 30% of investment grade bonds now have a yield below zero. And in a world where we've just seen our first negative interest rate mortgage out of Denmark, which just blows my mind. This negative rate madness, coupled with a record low gold/silver exposure in the developed world, and Rick Rule in a previous Palisade interview brought up a great stat, that the average U.S. investor has only 0.5% of his or her wealth in precious metals versus a 30-year mean of 2% and a high of 7 to 8% in the 1970s, which leads me to believe that this bull market has plenty of room to run. And if/when it does, we have plenty of exposure to it. All that said, I don't expect to initiate any new gold or silver positions in the MJG portfolio before the end of this year, at least. I'm more than content to continue to hold our existing names that are delivering and to sell those where management either goes off the rail, the company gets unlucky with bad results, the share price rises too far above fair value, etc. So my focus now over the coming months will be to fortify existing high-quality base metal and energy metal positions, and maybe add a new name or two to the portfolio that are non-gold or silver focused. If we don't see a severe global slowdown before the next U.S. presidential election, I'm of the opinion that base and energy metals will follow in gold and silver's footsteps and move higher starting sometime next year. So I don't want to get too overweighted to PMs, and I'm happy where we are right now.
Okay, let's talk about a few of the key books or authors that you've found important during your career so far, Matt. I know you've enjoyed The Bonanza King, so is there anything else that you've read recently that we'd like to share with us?
That's a great question. I would classify The Bonanza King as one of my absolute favorite mining biographies in terms of books that have shaped my career, and a few have come immediately to mind. The first is Liar's Poker by Michael Lewis, who's one of my favorite authors, which I read as an impressionable and naive first-year student at the Wharton Business School at the University of Pennsylvania. At that point, my plan in life was to scale the ranks of Wall Street as an investment banker, to live in Manhattan, to wear a tie to work in the morning, drive a black Mercedes, the whole nine yards. After all, Wharton is a renowned Wall Street theater school, and many of my classmates are following this exact path today. That said, Lewis's dose of reality really helped me realize that it would be much better for me personally and as an investor to take the road less traveled and steer clear of the Wall Street rat race. So this gave me the encouragement to chart my own path. And a couple years later, I founded the MJG partnership and have been doing that ever since. So switching now to value investing specifically, I will say there's no excuse not to read Ben Graham's The Intelligent Investor, and yes, Security Analysis also. I would start with The Intelligent Investor if you are unfamiliar with Graham's work, and then move on to the tome-like Security Analysis. I view these both as absolute mandatory reading, and it has directly led to some of my investment biases, which include investing in cash boxes and net nets, and also excitement about some of the part stories. Most of Graham's direct teachings are actually not directly applicable to the niche industry that is junior mining, but I do think an appreciation for his way of thinking is invaluable for investors in our space. And then a couple more for you. In terms of a contrarian investment psychology, two books stand out to me, one older and one new. The first is Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, which is an absolute classic that was written in the 1800s by a Scottish journalist named Charles Mackay. The book covers a long history of economic bubbles, manias, and what he calls popular delusions. And examples include the Mississippi Company, the South Sea Bubble, and Tulip Mania. This is right in the wheelhouse of those of us in mining, where we seem to have our own manias every 2 to 3 years. Having a historical perspective for bubbles helps one not follow the crowd when it is most tempting to do so. And then I'd say more recently with this behavioral economics tilt is a book by James Montier, which I believe was written 10 to 15 years ago, so much more recently. It's called The Little Book of Behavioral Investing. This one was particularly useful for me as a starting point, given that at the time that I read it, I had a minimal background in behavioral economics. He covers all of the main psychological stumbling blocks that we encounter as investors, some of which that come to mind would be over-optimism bias, confirmation bias, conservatism bias, the sunk cost fallacy, self-attribution bias, hindsight bias, loss aversion, the endowment effect, outcome bias, the list goes on. So it is a very, very comprehensive review. And after reading this book, I was in fact inspired to start keeping a decision journal, or what I call as a decision journal, where I highlight my emotions and thought process for each and every buy or sell decision I make. By doing this, I can look back on good and bad decisions to get an unbiased window into my thinking at the time and learn from both the mistakes and successes. So from the behavioral perspective, James Montier's The Little Book of Behavioral Investing, and then Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds are two must reads.
Fantastic. Okay, it would be interesting to talk to you, Matt, about the process you go through in determining when you sell a stock. Do you have a set of rules that determine if something should be sold within your fund, or is it simply a series of red flags that you're constantly looking for? For example, the story of that particular stock has changed, or management hasn't executed on their promises, or there have been too many financings in too short a place of time. Are these some of the things you look for, or is it simply price action and lack of it, and you found a more compelling investment or speculation to put your capital into somewhere else?
Yeah, another good question. I think across investments, whether it's generalists or those focused on junior mining, we focus far too much on when to buy and don't put enough attention on when to take profits. From a bird's eye view, I'd say that there are three main reasons to sell, the three things I look for when I'm selling. The first is when your original investment thesis is no longer intact. If that occurs, it's time to hit the exits. Failure in this business isn't always management's fault. This is a risky business, and sometimes things do not simply work out as expected. Maybe you speculated on a step-out drill program, and if the results come out and the assays come out and you don't see the desired widths and grades that you were expecting, then sell. Maybe you bet on a company receiving a drill permit or a mining permit that the market thought was questionable. If the required permit is denied or more commonly delayed for an unreasonable amount of time, then liquidate that position, move on. Maybe you invested in a company in a risky jurisdiction that looks like it may have a tier one project and you traded off geopolitical risk just due to the sheer upside. The company releases a PEA or a pre-feas and you're not blown away by the results of the study, and you no longer believe that the reward outweighs the risks of investing in that country, then step away and hit the bid. These are all hypotheticals, of course, but the point is that if your original investment rationale for initiating the position has changed, you need to have the discipline to move on. I'd say the second key reason to sell is when the share price exceeds what you deem to be fair value. This is generally a happier time to sell, as it usually occurs from share price gains versus, you know, failure on the company's behalf. But it can be just as difficult to remain disciplined when this occurs. Maybe invested in a soon-to-be producing copper asset and have a share price in mind for what the company should be valued upon production. If the share price is hit before first production without a material change to the company's fundamentals, then take profits or take your initial position off the table. Maybe invest in a pre-fees stage silver project where you deem the appropriate NAV multiple to be somewhere between 0.25 and 3. If the valuation of the company exceeds 30% of NPV without a material change to the company's prospects, then again, take profits or sell entirely. Maybe invest in a prospect generator at a substantial discount to its cash and marketable securities. And if this scenario, if the share price surges and the company begins trading with a positive enterprise value more in line with its peers, then move on to another opportunity. Again, these are just a few examples that I've thrown out there, but I believe they illustrate the broader point of having the discipline to sell when your price target is hit and exceeded. And the third reason to sell is a loss of faith in management. Here I've put together a quick laundry list of things in no particular order that can cause me to lose faith in a given management team. Insider selling, unreasonably large option grants, unexpectedly high G&A expenses, the implementation of a new change of control clause, management spreading themselves too thin amongst other commitments, key management departures, unexpected financings at low prices, a deviation from management's stated plan or business model, the appointment of an unsavory character to either the board or the operational team, the delayed filing of financials, improper disclosure of material information, excessive spending on marketing and travel. The list really goes on and on. This is not an exhausted list. All of these are causes for me to lose faith in a given management team and to liquidate the given position.
Excellent. Okay. Previously, we talked about the uranium market, and it appears as though more patience is still needed as the sector continues to bottom out. So what are your thoughts on uranium today, and what would signal to you that it is now time to become invested in the space? Is there a particular catalyst that you're looking for, Matt?
So I'll keep this answer pretty short. In hindsight, I was naively optimistic that a final determination on the Section 232 petition by President Trump would be a positive catalyst for the uranium space. Clearly, everybody else out there thought this as well. And when the decision came to pass, really the exact opposite occurred. This pessimism that has ensued in the 60 days since President Trump's decision is noteworthy in my mind, as even consummate uranium bulls like people like Rick Rule are tempering their expectations. I think this pessimism is overdone, frankly, and I'm expecting a strong seasonal uranium rally into the new year. However, assuming that this rally does come to pass, I'm unsure whether it will be the start of something bigger or rather just another head fake similar to what we've seen on and off over the past 4 to 5 years. Again, I'll emphasize that uranium is not investable for anyone with less than a 3-year time horizon. In terms of uranium equities, there are a few worthy of open market purchases in my mind, but not many. The ones that immediately come to mind would be Kazatomprom, Cameco, NextGen, Denison, and maybe the big three in the United States. That's Energy Fuels, Yara Energy, and UEC. For those that want to speculate on the potential upside surprise from the working group commissioned by President Trump. Besides these names, however, I really would not consider buying anything else on the open market. I have been watching 3 to 4 Athabasca-based juniors very closely, but at this point I've determined that we will only enter these positions through private placements, if at all. So I think for most of the uranium equities, it's a waiting game for private placements. Otherwise, you need to be very, very selective with your picks.
As we begin to wrap up, Matt, is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners today? Anything else on your mind?
No, I think this was pretty comprehensive, Karem. I appreciate you having me on the program. If any of your listeners want to reach out and learn more about the MJG partnership or even just trade ideas about different holdings in the space, they can reach out to me through the contact form on the MJG website. That's mjgcapital.com. And I look forward to chatting with your listeners.
It's been a pleasure having you on the show again, Matt. I'm sure we'll have you back on later in the year.
Thanks again, Karem. Talk soon.
think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?